Well, let's go ahead and jump in to our lesson tonight on archaeology in the Bible. If you remember in our last lesson, we were talking about the question whether or not the Bible that you have is reliable. And in our last lesson, we talked about the Old Testament or the Hebrew Scriptures. In this lesson, I want to ask the same question because there are probably as many or more critics of the New Testament than the Old Testament. So we're going to take a look at the New Testament and how can we know that the Bible that we read, the New Testament that we read, is what Jesus actually said, is what God intended for us to have in our hands. Let me remind you, though, by way of review, as we go back in archaeology, biblical scrolls, this is New Testament and Old Testament, biblical finds are sometimes in the form of scrolls. We talked about the ways that people made scrolls, and so some of them are written on paper or papyrus. And in this particular lesson, you will see a lot of paper or papyrus archaeological finds, but also onto parchment or leather scrolls. So in the upper left of this slide is the Great Isaiah Scroll from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Think maybe 200 years approximately before the time of Jesus. So that scroll, almost complete copy of the book of Isaiah, 66 chapters, is about 2,200 years old, written on parchment, on leather. And so scrolls were used for all documents for a long, long time. But then people began to use, and Christians were amongst the first to begin to use what's called a codex. We would just call it a book. Basically, leaves of paper, usually stitched together into a book format. Well, those could also be paper codices, written on paper and bound together, like a paperback book you might have today. But if you had a lot of money, and if you had a very important document, you might put it also on parchment, on leather. This is a little bit beside the point, but I was researching the Book of Kells, which is a copy of the Gospels that is in Dublin, Ireland, and it is written on parchment, lambskin, calfskin, and I was just, it's basically not the entire Bible, but I saw an estimate that it took 138 animals, 138 calves, to provide enough skin to provide for the Book of Kells. And so why am I telling you that? I'm telling you that because to put something on leather, on parchment, was extremely expensive in the ancient world, and you would see it reserved for books that were very, very important. So on to our question. Is our Bible a reliable transmission of God's revelation? Or is the Bible that you have, I like to think of it this way, what God wanted you to be reading? Is that what God wanted to say to you and to me? And I want to focus on the New Testament or the Christian scriptures in this lesson. So let me start by telling you that many scholars doubt, and in popular opinion, there have been a lot of documentaries, been a lot of books read that says, basically, you cannot trust the text of the New Testament to be anywhere close to what was originally written down. So, for example, when the Apostle Paul originally wrote the letter to the Philippians, for example, that what you read in your Bible today, this is the criticism, is you have no guarantee whatsoever that that closely resembles what Paul wrote down. So that's the fundamental accusation about the New Testament. Probably one of the more the great popularizers of this these doubts is a man named Bart Ehrman. Bart Ehrman is a Greek scholar. Bart Ehrman does not believe that the Bible has been accurately transmitted, and he's written a lot of popular level books that in my view are very misleading to you. And I want to address the accusations head on. I want to tell you where they're true, and I want to tell you where they're not true. So here's an example out of his book, Misquoting Jesus, The Story Behind Who Changed the Bible and Why. I think that probably answers your question on which side he's on that argument. But here's what Bart Ehrman had to say. What good is it to say that the autograph is the original, to use my example, the original document that the Apostle Paul wrote, or the original gospel that John wrote down? That's an autograph. We don't have the autograph of any ancient documents, so that's nothing new. But what good is it to say that the autographs were inspired by God? We don't have the original. That's true. We don't have the original of anything. I don't even have the original of my cell phone agreement, but that's another story. He says, we have only error-ridden copies, and I want to focus on that in a little bit. He would say we have error-ridden copies, and the vast majority of these copies are centuries removed from the original and different from them, evidently in thousands of ways. There are more variations among our manuscripts, let me substitute, copies of the New Testament or partial copies of the New Testament, than there are words in the New Testament. Well, you can understand when you see that, and if you believe that, you would say, wow, I don't think that I would even buy a Bible because it's not even remotely what they wrote down. You would get that impression reading this. So what's he actually contending? He's contending that these manuscripts, these portions or complete parts of the New Testament, have errors in them, whether deliberately or inadvertently. Secondly, that they're a long, long time from the originals, and consequently, you don't know what happened between the original and the copy we had. So much time has passed, you don't know what happened in that time period. Thirdly, that there are differences in these manuscripts, more differences in the manuscripts than there are even words in the New Testament. So I want to examine as we go through, I want to step through like we did the Old Testament, and I want to look at where does your New Testament actually come from? And so let's start our journey and let's work ourselves backwards to see if these statements are true and to what extent they're either true or misleading. So we'll start with our timeline. Here we are, of course, today in 21st century. And while there are arguments about everything I'm going to say to you, because that's what scholars do. They argue about things, and liberal scholars tend to argue in a deconstructive way. But realistically, your New Testament was written in this period from, let's call it, 50 to 100 AD. So here's when the original New Testament documents everything in there. I would argue Book of Revelation right at the end of the first century. But you basically have the letters of Paul starting in the maybe late 40s AD, Gospels coming along not that long after that. So basically from 50 to 100 AD, this is when it was actually written. And here we are about 1900 years later. So let's jump in and let's look at where does your New Testament come from? Well, let's start with some of the great foundational copies of the New Testament. And I want to show you three foundational copies. These all have names, and the name usually comes from where they were found. So for example, Codex Sinaiticus, the Sinai Codex, came from the Sinai in Egypt. That's where it was being housed in a monastery when it was found and brought back and then dated. And you'll notice I put the date on there is about 350 AD is when that copy was made. So I'll just start there and say that the Codex Sinaiticus has almost all of the Old Testament in Greek. We talked last time about the Hebrew Old Testament being translated into Greek called the Septuagint. It has that. In other words, it's a complete Bible in Greek. Has the Septuagint in Greek. It has a few extra books in it, like, for example, that the Catholic Bible might have. And it has the Greek New Testament. It has your New Testament in it. It is a complete Bible, basically. And it dates to about 350 AD. Codex Alexandrinus, the Alexandrian Codex, is in the early 400s, so around the same time period. It has, again, the Greek Old Testament and the Greek New Testament. It is, it and the Sinaiticus are both housed today in the British Museum, but their names come from where they were found, Alexandria, Sinai in Egypt, and that's why they're called what they are. What's important to us is the fact that they're pretty much complete Bibles in Greek and the dates. And then Codex Vaticanus. This is named this way because it's in the Vatican Library. This is probably the oldest complete. It is known as the oldest existing copy of the Bible. It's got the Greek Old Testament. It has your New Testament in it. And it dates to about 325 AD. And so let me go back to our timeline. And we have now moved back to about right here. Copies, and I'm just going to put the Vaticanus. Okay, so you can think about the three big texts from about 325 AD. Now, if you remember in our last lesson, and if not, feel free to watch that on the web, but in our last lesson with the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, we found that there were two largely complete copies of the Old Testament from around 1000 AD, so about 1,000 years old. It was the Aleppo Codex and the Leningrad Codex, meaning books. And they were copies of the Hebrew Scriptures. We're not talking New Testament now. The Hebrew Scriptures. And I told you then that that 1,000-year-old copy was the basis for Jewish translations of the Old Testament and Christian translations of the Old Testament. And that was a bit of a problem, wasn't it? Because they're only 1,000 years old. We went on to talk about that's why the Dead Sea Scrolls are so important, is they're copies of many, almost all the Old Testament books. It's not bound together. They're scrolls, kind of book by book. But they basically validate those documents from 1000 AD, and the Dead Sea Scrolls are from before the time of Jesus. So your translation of the Old Testament goes back to manuscripts 1,000 years ago, but basically match manuscripts from 2,000 years ago. And so your Old Testament is basically translated off of those. Well, you know what? You could translate your New Testament off of these three. And in some ways, it would be better if we did. We don't translate them. But if you took, and here's the point I want to make to you, if you took any one of these and you just translated it into English from Greek in your New Testament, you could be a Christian, happy as you could be. You would not have any serious doctrinal differences between someone who was using one of the other ones of these. In other words, they are match in every important respect. But we don't translate from these three. And so I have good news and I have bad news. And so my point to you is you would not have very many criticisms. Bart Ehrman would not be able to say what he said about there are thousands of errors and differences in the manuscripts. There are not amongst these three. They're largely in agreement. And you could be a Christian with any one of them. And if we just translated your New Testament from this, there wouldn't be any criticism. So the good news is we have thousands of copies of the New Testament. So I'm going to show you some charts. And my point here is not so much to say, oh, this is better than that. It's to put this problem or this blessing. It's a blessing and it's a problem. It's a blessing because we have almost 6,000 copies or parts of copies, and some of them are small parts, so it's not 6,000 full copies of the New Testament, almost 6,000 pieces or portions of the New Testament. That is overwhelming. But the bad news is that any difference gets multiplied 6,000 times, right? You got one document that says the, and another document that doesn't have the word the, you know what? They count that as 5,000 errors. So it's very misleading. But the only reason there is that criticism is you have this wealth of copies. So let's look at this chart for a second. Notice on the left, you have the New Testament in Greek, almost 6,000 copies or portions. And I want to be careful to say that some of these are very small portions. Some of them are just the letters of Paul. Some of them are various things. But this is a wealth of copies. Then, of course, in all languages, you notice there you have over 20,000 translations from back in history. Some of them also very early. They were translated from Greek into Coptic and into other languages as well. So those are useful. They're not Greek copies, but they're very useful. And the rest of this chart, you can look and see what some of the other great documents of history are. And you see how few copies, relatively speaking. Now, I don't mean to say by this that, and by the way, you're not going to get a lot of scholars arguing about Caesar's Gallic Wars. Look over here, Sophocles, Oedipus Rex, very famous play, three existing copies. Well, you know, if you only have three existing copies, nobody's criticizing it all that much and saying, well, I don't know if it's what the original was. Well, actually, you should have serious concerns that it's not necessarily the original. But you only have three copies, so we might as well assume that is what it is. And I'm not being flippant. That's really why you do or don't have a lot of criticism, in my view. So, for example, I don't have any problem reading Oedipus Rex and wondering, oh my gosh, I wonder if these are the exact words that he used at the time. It is basically, I trust the play that Sophocles basically wrote. But with the New Testament, you have so many copies that obviously there are going to be differences because people copied this. I'll talk more about that in a minute. So, good news, a lot of manuscripts. Bad news, a lot of manuscripts. So you could level charges like Bart Ehrman leveled against, but I hope you're starting to see that, wait a minute, that's very, very misleading. Next chart, look at the New Testament manuscripts by various languages. So early on, you get Coptic, Ethiopian, the Syriac on here, yeah, Syriac, and Armenian translations. Some of those are early, and you notice how many copies that you have. I mean, if you just put it all together, you're looking at 26 or 7,000 copies or portions of copies in a variety of languages. I mean, you have a wealth of information to know what this said. And it's not like, I'm going to talk to you about the differences in these manuscripts in a little bit, but it's not like in one of these, the Gospel of John has Jesus being the Messiah, and another one is like, no, the Gospel of John doesn't even talk about Jesus being the Messiah. It's nothing like that. They really are very substantially matching copies. And so you have a wealth of copies here. One more chart. This is the number of known Greek New Testament manuscripts, and I'm going to stick with that. The rest of this is very interesting, but since the New Testament was written in Greek, I'm just going to look at the Greek manuscripts and trace only the Greek manuscripts back in the language in which it was originally written. The others are very important and very, very useful. But for the purposes of this class, let's talk about the Greek manuscripts. Well, you're going to see that you don't have any manuscript from the first century. Well, that doesn't surprise me. They were written from 50 to 100. I'm not telling you that you won't find a copy from the first century. We just don't currently have a copy from the first century, but we do have a few fragments from the second century. And I'm going to go into that in some detail because I want you to see how close you can get with some of these finds. Notice you get into the second century is the 100s. Third century, notice the number goes up. That's the 200s AD. Fourth century goes up into the 300s. That's where we pick up Vatican. Our three great codices are right there in the early 300s. And then as you go through time, you have a lot of Greek copies through time. And so they total to around 6,000 copies or pieces of the Greek New Testament. So I wanted to give you those charts because I want to explain and put some context around this. I want to look at the age, how close to when they were originally written can we get? because that's important. I mean, it's a real indicator of how accurate it is. But the second thing is, how much do these documents agree? Well, with the Old Testament, it wasn't as big a deal because there aren't as many of them because the originals were written way back in history. These originals are written 1,900 years ago. That's a long time, but we have some really good, close evidence of it. In fact, we have, sometimes would argue, we have too much evidence, and that opens the door for some criticism. So let's talk about the New Testament that you have today, a modern New Testament. So what I have here is your modern translation, and it doesn't matter which one you have. The differences are very small, but I want to tell you where it comes from. So this is the oldest complete that we have, 325 AD, the Codex Vaticanus, and then next in 350, Codex Sinaiticus. And so those two, if you just, as I said, if you just translated those two into English, you would not have very many criticisms. I mean, you might say, oh my goodness, your document's from 325, it's 200 years after they were written. That's not much, right? But even so, that would be about all the criticism you could get. You couldn't argue that there were differences because there aren't very many differences. 6,000 manuscripts, yes, you have differences. Now I want to talk about why for a moment. Why are there differences? The way most of these were copied were by voice. I want you to think about this for a minute. Suppose you're in a monastery. I'm not telling you that's the only way you can copy it, but if you're going to hand copy and you're going to have your copy of a codex and you're going to make a copy of it and one scribe's making one copy, that's really slow. And I'm sure it probably happened that way, but that's not the norm for how you copy manuscripts. Think about it. Just a little economics will kick in here in just a second. And that is, you know what would be a lot easier? Is get 10 monks or scribes or people writing and have a reader who reads slowly and clearly. And 10 people. Now, the same time, you could make 10 copies instead of one. I say that to tell you that I want you just to think, because Bart Ehrman's not going to point this out to you and tell you. I'm going to explain to you why there can be a number of differences. So let's suppose I'm reading this document and I say, we went there. Well, half the scribes write down T-H-E-R-E. You went there because they're paying attention. You know, like, oh, I know it's T-H-E-R-E. Well, you got three of them that are, you know, they're a little sleepy and they spell it T-H-E-I-R. And now, all of a sudden, does that make any difference? It makes absolutely no difference. If you and I read it, we'd go, oh, I think he spelled that wrong. But we know exactly what it's saying, don't we? So there's no substantive issue there. But guess what? With 6,000 of them, they're going to count every one of those as a, quote, error or difference between them. And I want you to understand how absolutely misleading that statement is. But that makes perfect sense, and it's what you would expect. And so if we did that for a whole New Testament, I would expect you to have some misspellings. Someone that heard the word spelled it one way, someone heard it spelled it another way. That makes sense? That's how these are generally copied, and that's why you could say there are more differences in these 6,000 manuscripts than there are words in the New Testament. That makes it sound really unreliable, but it's not. It's just playing a silly game of counting every one of those as an error, as a difference. So I'll leave that alone, but I really want to hit that home because they're not going to tell you that in the documentaries. Bart Ehrman's not going to tell you that, but fundamentally, that's the substance of what he's saying. It's a very sensational thing to say, but it really doesn't have any substance to it. So how do we translate? What is in your New Testament? Well, the Old Testament, it comes from two documents. New Testament, you can buy a New Testament, not easy, that's basically from one manuscript tradition if you want to. But the way New Testaments, because we have so many documents, the way they're done is you have this field called textual criticism. And so there are scholars who, and their entire institutes, they get together and they look at, and they say they're going to translate the book of Philippians, say, into English in your New Testament. And they'll look at all of these copies of Philippians. You know what they do first? Get rid of the misspellings and go, well, it's pretty obvious that T-H-E-R-E is what was meant here, not T-H-E-I-R. So they basically put all of that correctly in there, which you would expect. But occasionally, there are more significant differences. I don't mean theological differences. I just mean wording differences. There might be a handful of manuscripts that have a verse in there that's not in most of them. That's why in your Bible, they'll say the best ancient manuscripts occasionally, you don't see this a lot, don't have this verse, or the best ancient manuscripts don't have that word. What that means is you get out of these 6,000 copies, you've got somebody that added something, and now maybe 50, over the next 200 years, 50 copies repeated it. But when you look at all of them, you go, that is not accurate because I've got 500 that say something else. Does that make sense? That's called textual criticism. So your New Testament is basically looking at all of the manuscripts that we have and saying, out of all of this, it quickly becomes clear what was the authentic reading. So what you have in your New Testament is not from any one document. It's taking the wealth of documents and pulling it together and saying, it's pretty clear what's the authentic original reading of this. So your New Testament is eclectic, meaning it's not coming from just one text, but the fact that you have so many means that it's extremely likely that this represents what was originally written and what you originally want to see. So again, you could be a Christian with any of these, but the way we do it today is since you've got so many, why don't we just make a science out of this and get as close as we absolutely can to what it originally said. Remarkable, unlike any other document in the world or in history to have this many manuscripts. Again, it opens you up to criticism, but actually it works for you in terms of accuracy. That's the New Testament. Now, I'd like to continue our little search backwards, and I want to just highlight some of the finds in the last, 100 years-ish or so, because you keep finding older and older pieces or copies of the New Testament. So let's take a little journey here and let's look at some of the most important finds for the New Testament. First one is called the Bodmer Papyri. The Bodmer Papyri are called that because these papyri were purchased by Martin Bodmer. And so the naming of these, sometimes it's who bought it, sometimes it's where it's at. There's no rhyme or reason to what these are called, but there is a numbering system to classify them. So in 1952, at a place called Dishna, I'm going to show you on this map, Nag Hammadi is, it's right by Nag Hammadi. Nag Hammadi is important because there was a big find, and I'm not going to go into it here, of papyri of Gnostic Gospels, not the Gospels that are in your New Testament. Gospel of Thomas and things like that are found there. I've done a series on that before. It's not in the scope of what I want to talk about here. But in 1952, there were 22 papyri found in Egypt. Now remember, by the way, I'm saying papyri. You wouldn't expect papyri to last that long, but that's why most of these finds are in Egypt. And what I mean by that is when you bury them in the sand in that dry conditions, that paper is preserved for 1900 years. And so you're gonna see a lot of papyri. Not everything is, some of it's leather, but you actually can find paper, papyri copies of some of these things because of where they were stored. So these were purchased, these 22 papyri by Martin Bodmer. And I wanna show you a couple of them. The naming system, by the way, I'll start on the left with P66. P means papyrus, 66 is its number. P66 is dated to right at 200 AD, and it is the Gospel of John. You see a picture of it there. You'll see in P72, in the middle picture, is a copy of Jude, 1st and 2nd Peter. It's also in the early 200s. I like this picture because you can tell that it was a codex. It's a book. This was interesting when it was found because most scholars thought that codex, the codices, books, weren't used until the 300s AD, 4th century, 300s AD. And lo and behold, here are codices from early 200s and about 200. I'm not telling you that to disrespect the scholars. I tell you that for this reason, that you should pay attention to what scholars say. They've studied hard, they have a critical method, but don't put too much authority in what scholars have to say. And good scholars will tell you this too, because you don't know what hasn't been dug up yet. In other words, it was a general consensus for quite some time that you don't see codices till the 300s. Then all of a sudden this shows up and you go, oh, I guess the Christians started using it 100 years earlier. So again, my point is not to be disrespecting scholarship. My point is to say, don't take anything with total authority, because things have changed, they will change, and never bet on what hasn't been dug up yet. This is a huge find, because now all of a sudden we've got several fragments of New Testament documents, and now we've gone back, let me go back to our timeline, we've gone all the way back from Vaticanus, so now we've got the Bodmer papyri, and we have pieces of the New Testament back to around 200, early 200s. So the finds just keep moving this back in time. And so those are the Bodmer papyri. Again, 1952, fairly recent. And they found more than this, but I wanted to show you some of these pieces. Well, let's go on to the next. This is the Chester Beatty papyri. Again, named after a person. These are 11 codices that were purchased on the antiquities market by Chester Beatty in 1931. They are currently housed in the Chester Beatty Library in Dublin, Ireland. A few years ago, my wife Laura and I went on vacation to Dublin, and we went up there, and she thought we were on vacation. I went to see this and the Book of Kells. And so I went to see the Chester Beatty Library. In all seriousness, we had a great vacation, and my wife is probably as much of an archaeology nerd as I am. So it worked out really well, but you can see these in the Chester Beatty Library in Dublin, Ireland. So at the time, these were the earliest codices found, and again, right around 200 AD. One of these, P45, which you'll see on the left, and by the way, you can see this is where it was stitched, by the way. You can tell this is a book. These are the leaves out of a book. But notice what is found here. The four Gospels and Acts from the early 200s. This is the four canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I'm not talking about the Gnostic Gospels and secret Gospels and all that. But in the early 200s, you have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. This is important. I'm just kind of a sideline, but one of the things is that people want to argue that the Bible wasn't canonized until Council of Nicaea 325, and that there were all kinds of gospels out of there, and Constantine gets all the people together in 325, and he says, look, we got too many gospels, let's just pick Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I'm exaggerating a little, but it's that the claim. Look what we have here. Early 200s, you have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And the point is, nobody got together and decided what was in the New Testament. Christians over time knew what was inspired. They knew this came from an apostolic source. And you find Christians using what's in your New Testament far before the Council of Nicaea. So I think this is very interesting that you see the four Gospels and Acts from the early 200s. This is also important because in P46, another piece of the papyrus out of the Beatty collection, you see large part of the letters of Paul from about 200 AD. And this also has, in my view, important implications. But let me just say that here we are, early 200s, around 200 AD in the Beatty papyri. Now all of a sudden, we've got four Gospels, Acts, and the letters of Paul. You've got collections, if you will. You've got things being put together into a lot of what looks like your Bible today. So let's go back, and I want to add this to our chart. So now same time period. You have the Beatty papyri, but to me, what's important here is obviously the age, around 200, but also the fact of what is being collected at such an early state in time. As you begin to see something that's starting to look a lot like your New Testament, bound up in a very early, early period of time. Okay? Let's keep going. I want to look at a couple more here. This is called the Magdalen Papyrus, and it's maybe no longer as big a deal as it was when it was originally found. But this was purchased in Luxor. Now, you notice that sometimes I'm going to tell you that something was excavated, and other times I'm going to tell you that something was purchased. And so if it's excavated, it has good provenance, meaning you know where it came from, and it was dug up, and you know whose hands it changed into. That pretty much keeps you from thinking something was forged. You can get the chain of custody of the evidence, so to speak. Other things show up on the antiquities market. Well, they could be frauds, they could be fakes. You don't know where they came from. They generally, in the archaeological world, things that you buy on the antiquities market, that's not such a good thing. Nevertheless, a lot of authentic things are sold that way, and this is one of them. This has been dated to earlier than 200 AD. I mean, you'll get different scholars with different opinions of dating this to earlier than 200 AD. It's a small fragment. This was purchased in Luxor, Egypt, and it was donated to Magdalen College, Oxford. And that's why it's called that. It's housed at Magdalen College in Oxford. But this little fragment, as you can tell, by the way, it comes from a codex. How do I know it comes from a codex? Because it's written on both sides. Remember, scrolls only written on one side, but a book you write on both sides of the sheet. This is written on both sides, so it came from a codex before 200 AD. So Christians were very early in adopting the book format. It has a fragment of Matthew on it. And so now, again, this is not like anywhere near a complete copy of anything, but my point is now we just keep backing up copies or little pieces of copies in time, which tells you these things were circulating. Now, the Magdalen Papyrus doesn't tell you, well, what did the whole book of Matthew say? I don't know, but I'll tell you it existed then, and it was being copied then, and the pieces that we have match. So it's important, even if they're smaller copies, you begin to push this back further and further in time. And so you get the Magdalen Papyrus sometime before 200 AD. Now I want to talk to you about a huge archaeological find. This is called the Oxyrhynchus Papyri. Oxyrhynchus, so I've told you about this area of Nag Hammadi and then down here in Luxor. But this was actually dug out of the ground in a city called Oxyrhynchus, Egypt. Oxyrhynchus was the third largest city in Egypt way back in antiquity. Okay, so it was a big place. It was a big administrative center. It was a large, large city in Egypt in ancient times. And as they begin to dig, they begin to come up with papyri, pieces of paper with ancient writing on it, ancient Greek writing on it. And people began to say, what is up with this? Well, two British archaeologists named Grenfell and Hunt, who are memorialized in this really good picture in the upper right, came to Oxyrhynchus, Egypt to see what are you guys digging up. You'll see in the middle a photo of the dig. And that photo is dig. This is happening at the very end of the 19th century, and very early, I think this picture's taken in like 1901 for the dig there. So they're digging this out of the ground in the early, early part of the 21st century. And it's been there a very long time, pretty well preserved. But it's not like you take a whole book out, dust it off, and open it up. These things are fragments, and it's like an ultimate jigsaw puzzle putting these documents together. And let me just give you a sense of proportion here. Out of this treasure of papyri, there are about 5,000 fragments that have been cataloged, examined, fit together, translated thing. But you know how many they estimate are there? 500,000. So obviously I want to make the obvious point here. We have no idea what else might be found. In other words, these things were dug up at the beginning of the 20th century, and I'm going to show you some fascinating finds here, but we've just the tip of the iceberg. There are going to be PhD students for the next 100 years going through this. Who knows when the paper will say, oh my goodness, we've just found the new oldest piece of the New Testament there. So I just want to plant that seed that don't bet on what hasn't been discovered yet, because there is a lot out there, and not just dug out of the ground. There are all these fragments that have yet to even be examined to see what are they. Well, this is interesting because this is a trash dump. Once you get in there, you realize these have all been thrown away. We're in the city dump here. And so we have all these documents, and there are municipal documents, there are contracts, there are wedding contracts. Probably one of the funniest things that was dug up here is a contract with a wrestler who has signed this contract, and he has agreed to throw his next fight for in exchange for money. I mean, you see everything in here. You see some ancient works of literature. You see a ton of contracts. You see some litigation going on, which is fascinating. I mean, it would be interesting just to study the non-biblical things from here. Nevertheless, let's stay focused. What have we found there from the New Testament? So in the New Testament, this pushes it back. These are the second and third oldest examples of little pieces from the New Testament, which is what's been found so far. And this comes out of the Oxyrhynchus garbage dump. And there's plenty more to be looked at. So P90, piece of papyrus, given the number 90, is a fragment of John 18 and 19. So again, these are small pieces, but even the small pieces are significant to us because it tells you it was being copied, and it's just a matter of time, I think, before other copies are found. So this, however, is dated to between 110 and 150 AD, and P104 is a fragment of Matthew chapter 21 around 150 AD. And so out of the Oxyrhynchus find so far, we can now go back to our timeline. Now we're going to push back all the way to 150. Now, don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not trying to mislead you and say we have a full copy of the New Testament from 150 AD. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that if you're going to build your New Testament off of two very good copies that are substantially complete from about 325 AD, you're also supplementing it by hundreds, even thousands of portions that you find. And some of these little portions take you all the way back to mid-century. And so here we have the Oxyrhynchus finds, the second and third oldest, circa 150 AD. We're pretty close now, aren't we? You're starting to see fragments of copies of Matthew and so forth, John in this case, from within 50, 70 years of when it was actually first written down. We're starting to get back. And my point is not that you could say that that little fragment proves that your New Testament is good, but I'll tell you what it does is it doesn't disprove it. And that's interesting to me, is that these fragments aren't substantially different. I mean, if this thing was just willy-nilly, everybody's copying and everybody's getting it wrong, if it's like the telephone game, I told you what Jesus said and you told somebody else what Jesus said, I would expect to find fragments that are radically different, but we don't. So in a lot of ways, this is really powerful evidence. Okay, one more, and I'll kind of stop there. I'm getting you some of the most exciting and the earliest finds that we have, but these are not the only finds that we have. There are so many other interesting things to see. But let me end on this one, as far as this goes, with the oldest fragment that we have. This was acquired in 1920. This is called the Rylands Papyrus. This is a fragment of John chapter 18 on this. This is called the recto. This is called the verso. And what do I mean by that? It's the front and the back of the same page. So this is John 18, 31 through 33. And this is John 18, 37 to 38 on the back side. And so you have these little pieces. These are in the Rylands University Library in Manchester in the United Kingdom. Is where this fragment is housed. This is the oldest dated fragment that we have, circa 125 AD. And so back to my timeline. We've now moved to find a fragment from 125 AD, the Rylands fragment. So if you just look at this for a second, we wanted to tackle two major accusations against the New Testament. One, I want to dismiss pretty quickly, and that is there are so many errors or differences, a spelling difference they're going to call an error. Yeah, I suppose technically it is, but it's extremely misleading, isn't it? That you have way, way, way too many differences in the manuscripts. That's only because you have so many manuscripts, which helps you really home in on what it originally said. If you have something that's in dispute, honestly, having 6,000 fragments or copies is a good way to kind of home in on, well, and they don't do it this way. You don't just say, what do the majority of them say? They weigh them and they say, who's most accurate? Who were the best copyists? How many copies do you have that are the same, et cetera? But that science puts it together. And so you get this, you kind of debunk this idea that your New Testament's not reliable because there are differences in the papyrus. Of course there are. There's 6,000 of them. But the second accusation that you get is that you can't be sure that what you have in your, let's say, your documents from 325 AD, which are substantially complete, well, that's still 225 years from when it was written. That's like saying today, you can't really know what was in the Declaration of Independence because it was written more than 225 years ago. Well, obviously we have better copies now than they did then, but as you look at this process and you look at this timeline, what are you seeing? It just matches up. As you dig things out of the ground, or as you go into a university library and start looking at fragments that no one's looked at yet, and you go, oh my goodness, this has been here for 50 years, but nobody realized this, and this is the way a lot of these finds happen, this is the oldest copy of John. And that happens a lot. But as you realize, as that continues to happen, you know what happens? When's the last time you heard them say, oh, by the way, we went and looked at the Oxyrhynchus papyri, and we just now found 50 of them that are radically different. Matthew 18, 27 says something absolutely different. You don't hear that, do you? My point to you is, as you continue to find things, the tendency is overwhelmingly to support your New Testament. So I hope that this little journey back through time, if you will, with these documents, gives you an understanding of how misleading it is to make those critical claims of the New Testament. You have a huge, high degree of certainty that the New Testament that you're reading is exactly what God wanted you to see. Well, the next big accusation about the scripture that I think archaeology is going to really help us is, I want to go back, way back into the very beginning of the Old Testament. We've looked at the reliability of the Old Testament and the reliability of the New Testament. But there's another argument that can be made, another accusation that could be made is, okay, so yes, your Old Testament is accurate. Fair enough. You got the Dead Sea Scrolls, you have these documents. Yes, your New Testament is accurate, but your Old Testament is just repeating old stories from way back when. The flood story of Noah is just another flood story of ancient times. And the Law of Moses is just a reworked copy of the Code of Hammurabi from the Babylonians. And your New Testament, no, that's not what Jesus said. It's just a bunch of Roman and Greek philosophy. So do you see the next objection is saying, okay, so you've demonstrated to me that your Bible is accurate, but my accusation now might be, yeah, but all that stuff in there, those are just old stories, and there are tons of flood stories. Are there really? And are they the same as what's in the Bible? That's what we're going to talk about next time.